Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
It's The Wonky Show. A third of students want reform off campus. We're talking about what's really going on behind the data. It's been a big week for fees and funding in Scotland, and the Mickey Mouse row returns. But who's really taking the mick? It's all coming up.
And it is obviously reasonable for people to question the value of university courses based on, for example, academic rigour, student outcomes, broader societal value. But it's not reasonable for them to arbitrarily decide on this based on no evidence. So I'm afraid I see this article as really very lazy journalism.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Mark Leach, and here to chew the fat over this week's news. As usual, three brilliant guests. In Newcastle, it's Andy Long, Vice-Chancellor of Northumbria University. Andy, your highlight of the week, please.
Thanks. Yesterday, we had a tour of our soon-to-be-opened Northeast Space Skills and Technology Centre. It's going to be the home to some really exciting research and teaching on satellite and space science and technology, and we were accompanied by the North East Mayor, Kim McGuinness, who's a great supporter of this initiative.
Lovely. In Westminster, it's Jess Lister, Director for Education at Public First. Jess, your hard of the week, please.
Hello. Yes, mine is a bit of a brag, I'm afraid. We launched our report this week on national numeracy, and usually when you launch a report, you're looking for, you know, pick up in the Times or the Telegraph or one of the broadsheets. But I was delighted that for the first time, our report was discussed on This Morning on the sofa. So there you go, a report launch first for me.
Very good. And in North London is Debbie McVitty, Wonky's editor. Debbie, your highlight of the week, please.
Well, I had excellent meeting of the Audit and Risk Committee of the organisation that I'm a trustee of, which is the National Institute of Teaching, which sounds terribly dull, but actually we had a very lively discussion about internal audit, and that was very much the highlight of my week, and that's pretty sad, but there it is. Yep, so the Higher Education Policy Institute has conducted a third wave of polling of student views on free speech. The first of these waves was in 2016, so kind of around the time of Brexit. The second was in 2022, around the time of COVID. The third one, conducted just in November there and published this morning, is trying to explore whether the kind of, as some commentators have suggested, the era of woke is over, and sort of in light of the election of Donald Trump and kind of sort of sea change in kind of public views. So what I think we see here is some really quite mixed results. There's, you know, a growth in number and student numbers who think that universities are less tolerant of the free of expression of free range of views. So that's up to 47%, which is a little bit concerning. 52% think student societies are typically oversensitive. So that sort of tends us towards the idea that students are kind of coming away from the sort of what would be characterized as sort of anti-free speech positions. But support for safe space policies and trigger warnings has grown in that time. So that sort of shows you the other way. The eye-catching result that is all over the press this morning is that one third, about 35%, think that reform, the political party of reform, should be banned from campus. The earlier waves pulled on organisations like the EDL, BNP, UKIP, and there was sort of quarter to a third of students in earlier waves expressed support for those organisations being banned from campus. Reform is obviously something a little bit different. DK has unpacked this on the site today, and one of the things he notes that I think is really worth contextualising that data in is that the number not only includes reform voting students, so there's something going on there, but that also only 18% of students said that nobody should be banned from campus. There is something going on here about students' attitudes to political parties. There's loads of other questions in there about events, about memorials, about curriculum. I think one of the things that I take away from it is that there's a lot of students are kind of it depends camp. You know, there's a lot more nuance here than perhaps it looks like at first blush.
Right. Yes. Lots going on here. Jess, where to begin? Because, I mean, a lot of this looks quite contradictory on the face of it. I mean, 41% of reform voting students don't think reform should speak on campus. So is this about students in general and their attitudes to politics, or is there a kind of partisan thing going on here?
I think one of the first things you learn when you start doing public opinion research is that people can very comfortably hold just totally competing views in their heads and not see the logical inconsistencies of them. So, you know, this is a, it's a large sample, so it's 1,000 students. It's done by a reputable polling company. You know, HEPI is a reputable output. It's not possible to look at this and say, oh, you know, the sample is wrong or the poll was wrong. But what is interesting is thinking about sort of what sits behind some of the questions. So to me, the headline, you know, a third of students would ban Reform UK from campus, I'm actually really interested in exploring, do they want them banned or do they just not want to listen to them? And this has always been one of the kind of tensions in free speech policy is, you know, you can have your right to, you know, lawful free speech on campus, but you actually don't have a right for anyone to turn up and listen to you or to like you for your views. And sometimes all of these things kind of get really muddled up and really conflicted. So I suppose it's a really interesting finding. It's going to wind up all the people who like to be wound up by these things. It should cause everyone else a pause for reflection. Like, I don't think we should dismiss this. And I think there's a conversation to have about, again, what university leaders can do to kind of break down some of these, you know, polar opposites of views. You know, I don't mind freedom of speech, I just don't want to hear from these people, I just don't want to engage with this. I think that's a kind of a sort of substantive discussion here. But yeah, just in terms of the polling, I think it would be interesting to follow this up now with you know, polling shows you what people think, it doesn't ever really explain why. And I'd really like to kind of see a bit more of a discussion about, you know, exactly why do students think they should be banned from speaking, and what do they mean by ban in this context.
Well, yeah, it makes me wonder whether students have actually a bit more nuanced view than this makes out. I mean, Andy, there's lots of support for things like safe spaces and content warnings. Does that suggest that perhaps this language of banning and this kind of binary debate that is often what this kind of free speech conversation leads to, maybe that's just not where they are in their heads? Because, you know, as I say, could it be, Maybe it's not contradictory. Maybe these two things can exist at the same time, because their attitudes to these issues are different to essentially, you know, what the Telegraph wants to write about.
Yeah, I think Jess captured it very well in terms of, you know, whether students want to ban things or whether they just don't want to hear things. I guess social media and how people interact through social media somewhat colours people's expectations now. You know, in the past you might have expected to hear a range of views through different media. Now your social media channel can be largely focused on things that you agree with, and therefore you're more reluctant to engage with those that you don't. But I guess in the end, a certain proportion of the population would always like to ban things that they don't like. And I'm not sure that we know that students are terribly different to the rest of the population. You know, what we also know is that 18 to 24 year olds are far less likely to support reform than, for example, the Green Party. The most recent YouGov poll showed that 10% of that age group supported reform and 30% supported Green. It's interesting in this study that 7% of people want to ban Greens from speaking on campus. So you can put those two things together and say, you know, people always want to ban or not hear from people that they don't agree with. And because fewer young people support reform, more of them want to see reform banned or just don't want to hear from them.
And I think it's so marked. It's really interesting that in previous waves of this survey, you've had parties that are even more extreme than reform. So in the 2016-2022, we've asked about, you know, the BNP and the English Defence League and kind of these older, defunct, but still in the system sort of really right-wing parties. This year, if you put all the parties that were asked about on a scale of left to right, reform is the most extreme. And again, I'd actually be really interested in seeing, is the polling showing us that people don't want the most extreme parties to come to campus, or is it reform specifically? So there's a few other things in here that I think is interesting just to kind of peel out.
And can I just add, what I think really matters is how universities respond to this.
Yeah.
And I see no evidence that they're banning speakers from different political parties. The only piece of evidence I have here is when we had hustings for the mayoral elections, our students' union organised those, all of the candidates were invited. Actually, the reform candidate decided not to come, you know, and they'll have their own reasons for doing that, but they would have been very welcome to come and put their case forward and answer questions from our students, but they didn't want to.
I mean, I think student leaders are in a really interesting position here as well. I mean, and I am reminded of a conversation that I had at the Festival of Higher Education in November. So we're kind of around the time this polling was being conducted, with a student leader who was sort of wrestling with her responsibilities around the creation of a reform society on campus. So, you know, inevitably, it was framed in free speech terms. The students who wanted to kind of set up the society and invite the speakers and all the rest of it sort of felt very strongly about this, as did the students who really felt like this was inappropriate. And you know, as a student leader, she had to really navigate that space. And I think that kind of, that sort of nuance of how do you sort of listen to both camps? How do you kind of think about what the purpose of things like Reform Society, what wider purpose do they serve on campus in terms of supporting or perhaps not, you know, the free expression and sort of civic engagement and political debate? All of that is kind of, I think, part of this picture here.
Jess, can I ask you something, and then also make whatever point you're going to make as well, which is about Richard Tice, the Reform deputy leader. Jess, he's obviously jumped on this polling and says the findings are appalling. British universities have abandoned being centres of genuine learning, rigorous debate, and intellectual challenge long ago, instead opting to become echo chambers of far left indoctrination run by activist academics. Which obviously is kind of his position already. So this obviously plays very nicely into, you know, how he'd like to be talking about universities. So I guess this sort of talking about the institutional response, this kind of frames, doesn't it, the outline of the culture war quite starkly. And is there a danger that we're sort of muddying the water a little bit, because the nuance of the conversation is getting lost, isn't it, in the mainstream?
Yeah, I mean, it's students have left-wing views, should surprise nobody. That's been true, I think, since the dawn of time. Richard Tice believing that universities are far left indoctrination camps, again, is a long held view. Like, none of this is new.
No, he didn't use the word left-wing madrasas, which was the Sam Gimo line.
What I do think is interesting is actually the second paragraph of this, I think, actually gives the sector a bit of an answer here. So he says universities bear responsibility for allowing this culture to fester, but I think universities do now bear a responsibility for, again, helping and encouraging as a healthier debate as possible on this topic. So again, you know, if I was a university vice chancellor, I would generally be thinking about, you know, how can we get better debates on campus now? You know, we're a long way out from an election, but this issue is just going to bubble and bubble and bubble unless you are seen to do something and seen to change. And again, this is a debate that only ever interests the political elite and only ever interests, you know, this is never really a mass public opinion issue or a mass reputation issue, but it is like a barnacle issue on the sector's overall reputation. And I think some, you know, UCL's work on disagreeing well and sort of how to have debate on campus, including with people you disagree with, the more activity like that you see, the less these kind of attacks on, you know, echo chambers hold any weight. And the final thing I'd say is what's really interesting is how much this just draws from the US playbook. So the Republicans, you know, came into power under Trump for the second time. They had universities in their sights and they immediately just started stripping out grant funding. And they often used free speech as a rationale and a reason to do that. And again, you can see Reform kind of dipping the toe in the water about something like that here in the UK without really understanding the funding system that they're hoping to strip back. They're just kind of pulling from what's happened in the US and trying to make this a kind of UK-wide debate.
Yeah, I have something, I think, that sort of that's floating around my mind. And it's about woke as a kind of, as a sort of category of thing. So I think this is, because you know, the origins of the idea of woke is simply to say someone who is kind of attuned to social inequality, someone who sort of understands the ways that different groups can be marginalized, particularly in kind of, in, you know, racial and ethnic marginalization, but it sort of expanded its meaning to mean that. But of course, it's taken on this kind of life of its own. It's now used very pejoratively. It's coming from a very particular hostile ideological position to universities. And I think it would just be really, really odd if students themselves, who weren't kind of immersed in that world of kind of anti-wokery, were to kind of associate a basket of opinions and positions around free speech with that sort of woke label. I don't know that it, you know, I think the coherence of it is assumed in the minds of the people who are sometimes asking the questions or kind of analysing the results, but not from the students themselves. And one of the things that we know in Monkey is you know, our polling sees this, that there's a real link between a sense of freedom to speak on a personal level and being part of a marginalized group. You know, I think we can sort of too readily assume that freedom of speech means, you know, freedom to attack left-wing positions, right? Or, you know, it can be as much about feeling safe, feeling part of a community, feeling like you understand the purposes of speaking up, as much as it is about kind of entitlement and being exposed to things that are kind of controversial. And I think there's something really important here. You know, now that we have kind of gone through this whole process of the free speech debate and the legislation and the SAR and the system and the policies and all the rest of it, to really go back to the students and say, what actually matters to you in terms of taking part in a conversation? What is it? And, you know, and from a kind of pedagogical perspective, what is the purpose of this? What does it do in terms of your development as a graduate, as a future citizen, as a political actor? In a really, really complex political environment, you know, there's nothing straightforward about the idea of freedom of speech in the political environment we're operating in. And that feels like a bit more urgent in some ways than worrying about whether students are, you know, endorse trigger warnings or other kind of things that are associated with this idea of wokery.
Right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, I'm Sean Jackson, an employment partner at Mills & Reeve, specialising in the sector. After months of parliamentary back and forth, the Employment Rights Act 2025 finally made it into the statute books just before Christmas, with wide-ranging implications for the sector. From new rules on unfair...
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Dismissal and 0 hours contracts to tougher requirements on sexual harassment and major changes to industrial action. These reforms will have a real impact on how universities manage their people and risk. In my blog, I've set out 5 things that sector leaders need to know to prepare for these reforms with a handy table of implementation dates.
Now, Jess, it's been a busy month in Scotland. Tell us what's going on.
It has. So if we look across the border in Scotland, we've seen the launch of a future framework for universities, which is a joint government and sector initiative to scope out the long-term needs of Scotland's higher education system all the way to 2045. It's worth noting this isn't kind of a proper review. It's kind of just the start of an evaluation of the sector, its longer term financial sustainability, what it might need, what Scotland's economy might need. It's not a promise that anything, you know, in the current system is going to change. And as a reminder that I'm sure everyone is aware, you know, the Scottish system is much, much more reliant than the English system on direct government funding because Scottish students currently don't pay fees. So what the government decides its long-term settlement is going to be is really key. We've seen some indications that the Scottish government is willing to provide some further support. So there's been an above-inflation increase in teaching and research budgets announced this week, perhaps in the hope to avoid another kind of Dundee-style incident. And the final thing that's really interesting is sort of similar to England and Wales, the Scottish government is also now trying to scope out not just what a higher education funding strategy looks like, but also a tertiary one.
Mm. Yeah. So, Debbie, it's fascinating, isn't it? I mean, lots of straws in the wind here. This tertiary thing, though, is something that jumps out at us because we're kind of in England, it seems to be going back and forward all the time. And it's not clear that, you know, the tertiary is the desired way forward. But then there's always little bits of it. We saw some of it in the recent white paper. But what could that look like in Scotland? And what about the system there is kind of amenable for thinking about this in a more tertiary way? And is there something we can learn in England from that, do you think?
Lots of questions there. I mean, Scotland is already a bit more tertiary than England, to the extent that you kind of imagine tertiary as being a sort of not merely a sort of system level description of further and higher education kind of working together in that post-16, post-18 space, but also a sort of political way of thinking about creating a sort of fairly kind of broad-based post-16, post-18 offer. I think there's probably some politics going on here. I speak not from direct knowledge, but I think it's quite interesting that before Christmas, the minister announces the plan to kind of work with the university sector to look at the funding framework. And of course, that's something that will have been kind of, you know, the minister and University of Scotland will have worked on really closely because they'll have been thinking, right, how do the state of Scotland's universities is not only a problem for the universities themselves, but it is a problem for the country. You know, this is a genuine financial crisis, I think, that Scotland's universities are facing. And so they've kind of worked out this framework plan to say, let's really kind of get under the skin of the issues. Let's cross it over the election so that it can be part of the election conversation with Scottish Parliament elections in the spring. But it's not it extends beyond that. So there's some political cover there, depending on what happens. And obviously, you know, it's trying not to kind of get hung up on this question of free education, and is it all only about free education? And there's lots of kind of politics to deal with in that space. This tertiary approach is coming in as part of the tertiary education bill, so that's kind of probably the right place for it. But also, it wouldn't surprise me if, having kind of seen this thinking emerging from government and University of Scotland, that Scotland's colleges, I think, quite legitimately may have said, hang on a minute, when you're talking about a funding settlement for higher education, that's us as well. And we need to look at this in the round. And I think, you know, committing to a funding strategy, sure, I think it's probably a step above saying, well, we'll just do our annual budget and, you know, you'll get what you get. It's a really, I think, quite positive step towards saying, how does this system support our national goals? How do we make it sustainable? Whether that strategy, of course, I mean, it is, I think, in the nature of devolved governments to often put together strategies which say it'll be very good if we do X, Y, and Z, and then not really deliver on it, or to kind of use the strategy as a way to kind of keep the conversation going, but without necessarily committing to real action. It is genuinely hard to figure out how you fund higher education in the long term and make it sustainable. And so, positive steps, useful, I think, to think about it in the tertiary context. But, you know, there'll be an awful lot of slip twixt cup and lip, as Bernd said.
And just the framework reporting after the May elections, I mean, that's a feature, not a bug, isn't it? So is there something to be said for taking contentious higher education reform out of electoral cycles entirely?
I think as far as I'm aware, the SNP are expected to win overall, though winning with a sort of smaller majority than they have now. So one way of looking at this is just to start the ball rolling on something. It's easier to pick it back up again post-election than it would be to kind of start it again when everyone's priorities are elsewhere. The other thing is that I actually think the state of the sector in Scotland has demanded political attention at politically inopportune time. I think the precarity of the financial situation, the precarity of things like international student recruitment, which Scottish universities are much more dependent on, has meant that they kind of had to do this now rather than waiting. It's interesting. You don't normally see kind of big initiatives like this launched so close to an election cycle, but I think it's more in response to the sort of state of the sector and needing to at least do something and start a conversation now rather than waiting another 6 months.
Andy, I mean, Scotland's been on a very different funding track to England for a long time now. And I wonder, when you're looking, you know, north of the border, you know, clearly financial pressure, there's been financial pressures on both sides.
So when I go to meetings of fellow vice chancellors and, you know, start a conversation with somebody and say how challenging it is for English universities, if ever there's a Scottish VC in our group, they'll immediately stop you and say, well, it's just a lot harder for us. And you really need to consider that. Of course, as I understand it, Scottish universities receive up to £2,000 a year less per home nation student than English universities do. So it is really challenging for us. It's even more challenging for them. As Jess has pointed out, they're even more reliant on international student income for that reason. And of course, there's a relatively small group of universities in Scotland who can do very well in terms of international student recruitment because of their profile, which means there's less to go around for all of the others. We face our own challenges in the UK. You know, we've seen undergraduate fees flat for 11 of the last 13 years. We've seen reductions recently in international student numbers. So it is very challenging in England, but I'm under no illusions that the challenge is even greater in Scotland.
I'm interested in whether this provides a model for England to kind of catch up. So I think it's very clear going into the 2024 general election that no one wanted to touch higher education or higher education policy. I think I've long been of the view that that view would hold for this parliament, but not the next parliament. Like at some point, some kind of more substantive change was going to be needed above and beyond the kind of just index linking of tuition fees, which we've seen recently. So I suspect this kind of joint sector, joint government review, but not promise model could be something we sort of see towards closer into 2030. The question in my mind is whether it is a waste of time. Again, like everyone getting together and agreeing that the sector isn't financially sustainable and here's what the long-term needs look like, without the kind of political and funding heft behind it to change something about it, leads to a kind of very good conversation and not much output. But we'll see. I will remain optimistic for now.
I think that's really interesting, Jess. It would be great to see such a review to look more fundamentally at how things are funded. I fear it will just never be a high enough priority priority for any of the political parties. I do like my stats, and there was a great stat from London Economics Report a few years ago that said that in England, students and graduates cover around 84% of the total cost of their higher education. So government funds just 16%. And there was a debate at the time about whether that reflected the balance between the public and the private good of higher education. And then contrasting to Scotland, where it's all funded by the government, and then Wales and Northern Ireland, where about 50% is funded by the government, and, you know, wondering which of those was the best system. I think the rhetoric from all sides of politics recently, pretty much all sides, has been that students should be paying for more of their higher education costs and not less. So I'm afraid that doesn't fill me with hope that we're going to see a more reasonable system that does reflect the public and private good of higher education coming forward in the near future. I really hope that we do, but I'm afraid I'm not expecting it to come.
I mean, as much every single stakeholder in the entire Scottish system will say, oh, this review isn't just about fees, you know. but it absolutely is, isn't it? I mean, and, you know, and privately, I think a lot of people will say, you know, we're going to have to take a run at this free education thing. It's such a kind of touchstone, particularly for the SNP. And, you know, Alex Salmond, sort of former leader of the party, sort of said, you know, the rocks would melt in the sun before Scotland's universities would, you know, not offer free education to Scottish students. And, it's a real kind of, you know, social lodestone, but it's just, yeah, there's going to have to be some kind of really, really clever politics to try and figure out whether there is any scope to introduce some kind of a student contribution and, you know, fair and progressive and all of that good stuff. But I mean, you know, and it's certainly not a popular opinion, but I think, you know, anyone who's kind of locked into Scottish HE policy feels like that's the job, you know, and I think, you know, we'll know in a year whether that job has been accomplished. And if it's not been accomplished, it's going to be continual. This sort of funding crisis, I think, is just going to continue.
Yeah, and it's interesting that Peter Matheson, VC of Edinburgh, you know, in his recent comments on this, talked about, well, he advocated a salary-based graduate repayment, but he did seem at pains to say he wasn't advocating introduction of tuition fees.
Mm. Yes, and there other models exist. It's just, you know, we've never found ways to implement them in the Westminster in England. You know, Scotland may be willing to roll the dice on something different, as you know, and. I hope that there is a kind of, I guess, a sort of appetite to try something bold, because obviously, you know, and nobody here will disagree, having thriving universities is really pretty fundamental, especially if you're a small country like Scotland that is really trying to kind of hold its own against sort of larger neighbours. So there's a real rationale for Scottish parties to roll up their sleeves on this one, if they're courageous enough.
Hi, it's Jim from the team here. AI hasn't just changed how students write essays. It's forced us to confront what learning actually means. As The Secret Life of Students returns for its 8th year, we're launching major new research revealing how students are really using AI, discussing what Graduate Ready means in 2026, and showcasing institutions already reimagining assessment for authentic learning at scale. Taking a step beyond what has felt like, for many, a moment of crisis, we're looking at it as a chance for creativity, and a chance to reimagine what higher education is actually for, to strip away assessments that measure memorization rather than meaning making, and to design learning experiences that develop capabilities no algorithm can replicate. At the event, you'll explore how AI can enhance rather than replace human learning, what that means for everyone, with a new government white paper reshaping the landscape from oracy initiatives to work-based learning at scale. The Secret Life of Students is the event you need. With institutions under pressure to demonstrate genuine learning gain, the timing couldn't be sharper. This is the essential gathering for anyone working on student experience, teaching practice, or education policy, where you'll get evidence, not platitudes, practical strategies, not theoretical debates, and a vision of higher education that's more human, not less. That's The Secret Life of Students, learning to be human in an age of AI, March 2026. Tickets are available now. Book on wonky.com/events.
Right, finally this week, we've been looking at the vexed question of Mickey Mouse courses on wonky.com. Andy, talk us through that, please.
The Taxpayer Alliance has produced an expose, which is reported in The Telegraph, based on Freedom of Information responses, which suggests that British universities have offered 787 Mickey Mouse courses since 2022. Now, I don't believe any of these courses are related to famous Disney characters. Instead, the TPA has used its own judgment to determine which courses fitted the bill and prioritise what they describe describe as woke studies and those linked to hobbies, as opposed to considering whether programs are likely to lead to a good job or hold cultural value, for example. So I think it's really important to note that the report expresses concern about how much these courses might be costing the taxpayer, and yet it includes no evidence on this, for example, on employability of their graduates or even whether they're funded through the student loan system. Topics they've highlighted as being woke include courses covering workplace health and well-being, gender and sexuality, and climate justice. And these are certainly topics I'd argue highly relevant to society today. And it is obviously reasonable for people to question the value of university courses based on, for example, academic rigor, student outcomes, broader societal value. But it's not reasonable for them to arbitrarily decide on this based on no evidence. So I'm afraid I see this article as really very lazy journalism.
And David, on those wonky articles, we've been looking at kind of the history of this term and sort of how it came about.
I mean, so honestly, I think it might have just been that we're all feeling a bit refreshed after Christmas, and when this report came out in the Telegraph, it just got us thinking about kind of this Mickey Mouse kind of label. Like, where did it come from? What's the kind of history of it? It started off as a Labour thing. It was in the UK, Margaret Hodge used it when in the New Labour government years. And so DK said, well, okay, how did it become something that is now a kind of right wing thing? But you know, what's going on here? So DK kind of dove into the history of it, and it's a sort of fascinating long tale of use of the term and what it means. But I think one of the things that he found is that, you know, the meaning of the term changes depending on who's using it. And of course, you know, fundamentally, as Andy points out, it really comes down to kind of questioning the value, which of course is a very, very contemporary debate. But of course, it takes different forms depending on what you think the value of higher education ought to be. So it used to be about sort of saying these are academically unrigorous courses or they're too easy. And now it's a bit more about sort of saying actually they're ideologically suspect. They're on the topics that we don't really approve of and we worry is contributing to this broader kind of woke agenda. So there's kind of lots of complexity in the term. And at the risk of kind of giving it really far too much more oxygen than it actually deserves, I did a bit of thinking this week just about if you're someone in a comms team who's trying to respond to this kind of question about tell us why you're offering all these terrible Mickey Mouse courses, what's your response? It's actually quite a hard thing to respond to because you don't want to allow the principle of the question to be legitimate, but you also, I think, need to see it as an opportunity to really say, well, what is it about these courses? Why do they deserve to be higher education? And I sort of thought about it and came to the conclusion that the rationale for any given course, it might be in the kind of complexity of the field. It might be about the industrial application. It might be about the outcomes that students get. It might be that the sorts of things you need to study it are very expensive, and that's why universities are kind of best placed to offer it. There might be all kinds of reasons, but that's going to be different depending on the university, depending on the mission of the institution, depending on the kind of the students are taking the course and the way the course is being constructed. So actually, it's very inherent to the course itself. And if you want to be effective as a comms practitioner, you probably do actually need to spend a bit of time with your courses and just really understand what those kind of what those rationales are and where the value is, so that you can mount that really full throughput defence.
Jess, I feel like you need to remind us about why people don't like lots of what happens in higher education.
That is usually my job. So some of this discourse always winds me up, right? Because critics, particularly on the right, are often the staunchest defenders of a kind of market-based system, right? Like, why do some of these courses exist? Because there's demand for them, because students want to do them and people are willing to, you know, exchange money for goods and services to do their sort of course on fashion or computer games. And organisations like the TPA are often the kind of worst defenders of, you know, I want a market system, but not like that. I want my market system, not your one. And that's where it all gets distorted. But I think the thing that sits at the core of this, and again, the risk of just dismissing this outright, is the continued debate about the return on investment for the student and the taxpayer from a university course. What this is actually about, I think, is the sort of long-running quality debate. And some of the courses the highlighted here are purely highlighted because they've got clickbaity headlines, and let's put them to one side. Some of them are highlighted because they've got relatively poor graduate outcomes. They've got relatively poor sort of evidence that they lead to good or better jobs. And I think we are exiting or have already exited the world in which, or maybe we've never been in the world in which kind of taking out a loan to study for the sake of studying is an acceptable thing to do for lots of people in these organizations. What they want to see is, you know, the student loan book going down, students going through universities, coming out the end and getting really good jobs and kind of, you know, becoming productive widgets in the economy. And I think that's what often sits at the heart of lots of this. And I think the sector is a bit too quick sometimes to dismiss the sort of Mickey Mouse discourse as just another attack line. And I think I'd be really careful, particularly when you get a headline a week at the minute about the decline of graduate jobs and the decline of the graduate job market, about how we make the case for not just the rationale for these courses, but also the kind of ROI on these courses as well.
It is obviously very important that universities pay, you know, attention to the employment prospects of their graduates. It's certainly something we take very seriously at Northumbria, which is why we make sure all of our undergraduate courses include experiential learning alongside traditional academic subjects. I guess the analysis can sometimes be very simple, and I would argue in this study it was incredibly simple. I didn't really see any reference to, you know, to actual data around graduate outcomes. It was more of a feeling that these courses won't lead to good outcomes, and you know, I'm not quite sure how the authors of the study can know that. So it is much more about what they think is of value and what aligns with their principles, their values, their political views, perhaps. If you look just at one example in the creative industries, you know, a much higher proportion in the creative industries of graduates will be self-employed. They're often not captured by some of the data capture mechanisms that we have, you know, graduate outcomes data, etc. In some subsectors, 70% of people are self-employed. And now I would argue that they may still be very productive. That may be very positive for them. And of course, they add a lot of value to wider society with what they do.
I think to some extent, it is a shame that the kind of, I guess, the opportunities, the points at which there is public attention on the debate about the value of higher education courses is always through that negative lens. you know, why is this not delivering the outcomes, as opposed to, you know, how do you defend this, as opposed to, I guess, you know, a positive good news story, which of course, as we know, doesn't exist. So there's something about sort of savvy media management here about sort of saying, well, you know, even that we are coming from this sort of defensive posture where we have to kind of justify and explain. But on the other hand, that is an opportunity to explain, because I think most people don't have a clue what is studied in university courses, other than the kind of perhaps the mainstream ones or ones that they might have personally experienced. Therefore, have no idea what the possible employment outcomes might be, or what the returns might be, or what that looks like for real people. You know, people in their, you know, who they might know, who might be interested in studying such things. So I think there is a real, you know, it's sort of galling that's the frame, but there is an opportunity to really talk about the meaning of higher education in these moments that is, I think, rarely afforded to universities in the kind of general day-to-day, you know, media landscape.
And I think my slight criticism of the sector sometimes is that, exactly as Debbie says, it sees the frame in which the debate is set and it decides it just doesn't like the frame. You get this a little bit with the free speech debate we were having earlier. I think more and more, as our sort of politics drifts around and our political elites sort of get more and more extreme in their views, you can no longer just kind of say, well, I don't want to engage in a debate on these terms. I don't really want to talk about jobs. You know, I don't want to talk about outcome. This is just an attack and I can dismiss it. I think we've got to think a little bit more carefully about how we sort of put the case forward. You know, there's a reason why universities decide to put these courses on. Like, tell people about them. Like, you know, explain your thinking, explain your rationale. And I think we're kind of past the point at which you can kind of just push these things off to the side and think that it will kind of just go away. These issues are just going to repeat, and they're going to continually put a damper on the sector's overall reputation, just at the time when it needs kind of to be building the broadest possible coalition of support for the good in what it does.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on monkey.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Monkey Show wherever you get your podcast. And if you want to get ahead of everything that's going on UKHE, just click subscriptions on the site to find out more. So thanks very much to Jess, to Andy and Debbie, and Michael Salmon for making it all happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next week. Jim will be here. Until then, stay wonky.